Oh, I stand. Well, our question for today is the Bible history? Is the Bible history? And I guess I want to start off by asking, what do we mean by that? What do we mean is the Bible history? Because people do history in different ways, and the whole question of what is history is an interesting question to look at anyway. But when I'm talking about history here, I mean, is it talking about real events and real people that are being discussed? When the Bible talks about things, as we've just had in that reading about Jesus of Nazareth being crucified, is that a real event in history, or is it just a myth? Is it just a fiction? So that's what we're asking today. I'm just going to look at the New Testament just for the sake of time, but I'm happy to take questions on the whole of the Bible. But in a half hour talk, really, I can only do the New Testament. It's a question that really matters to Christianity because we are actually a historical religion. Christianity is based on the claim that there was a man, Jesus Christ, who was the Son of God, who lived on this earth, who did certain things, who died for our sins, and who rose again. They're actually all historical facts, which actually makes Christianity different to many other religions where the history doesn't really matter. So for a lot of Buddhism, it's just the philosophy of Buddhism that the religion is about. And whether or not Buddha is real in one sense doesn't really matter. It's the teaching that we get into and that we engage with. But that's not the case with Christianity. With Christianity, there are certain events that we're saying did happen. Now, this is a question that is actually often asked in our society, though you may not be aware of it, but it's always being asked by the media. And I don't know everyone here today, but you may already have your answer to this question, is the Bible history? And you might say, well, no, it's not. I was speaking to someone just the other day and they were saying that they knew it wasn't because they've watched documentaries on this and they've seen these documentaries and it's made it clear. And in fact, this is the case. Over in England and Australia, before Christmas and Easter, the government radio, the government media generally put on hostile documentaries to Christianity. So did anyone watch Compass the other night, last Sunday night? No, it was a documentary called Who Wrote the Bible, and it was really one-sided and hostile to Christianity. And this is what Compass does in leading up to Easter. So this is what they're doing for their lead up for Easter, which is to attack the Bible. We're actually going to play a bit of this now because for many of us, this is what people will be saying. Sorry, I'm looking around for my box here. Where's my box? Can't find it. There's a video box around here. There it is. Can you see it? This is the one. I just bought this at the ABC bookshop in town. This is shown on the ABC. It was either SBS or ABC. I can't remember now, but it was shown there. It's been shown, I think, a few times. It's a three-part one called Who Wrote the New Testament? And we're going to have a look at this because for many people, this is their first experience of this question. So let's see how we go. Now, I just want to look at those two points that he makes there because things like that are being said in the media all the time. You see, Mark couldn't have been the author because there's just all these geographical mistakes. And as I said, this is what's on the ABC regularly, these types of things. And I just want us to actually consider this. So his first claim there was that Mark couldn't have been the author because in the account in Mark chapter 5, when Jesus heals a man who was demon-possessed and the demons go into a pig and then the pigs run down the hill and they die in the sea. I'm sure for the Christians we're familiar with that story. And his point is that the city or the town of the Gerasenes was not next to the lake. It was about 3 miles away from the lake. And so, you know, when Mark's gospel says that Jesus went to this town and did this, that actually shows that he didn't know the geography because the town wasn't next to the lake, and so it just shows that, you know, it wasn't written by someone who actually knew their stuff. So let's have a look at this. Here's the first one. Hi, come in. It says they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. Now if you actually look at that, and I've checked this in the Greek, it doesn't even say that he went to the city of the Gerasenes. It just says he went to the region. And the region is around the city. And it's only 3 kilometres from the town to the lake. So the guy actually hasn't actually read the Bible carefully. His next point was that, and I've given you a map here, that when Jesus came down the coast, where he went from Tyre to Sidon to the Lake of Galilee and then to the Decapolis, he said, his point was that if you were going, again this is on your map here, if you were going to the Sea of Galilee, you wouldn't go from Sidon, Tyre, then down through the Decapolis, then up to the Sea of Galilee. You can see how you've sort of gone the wrong way around. You'd go to the lake first. But if you actually go and look it up in Mark, it doesn't say that at all. So here's the one from Mark chapter 7. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee, and into the region of the Decapolis. So it's not, it's just actually outlining quite a simple path that Jesus went. It's not that he was going to the lake and he went through the Decapolis, it's that he went to Galilee and then went on to the Decapolis. It may sound really obvious, but I bring this up because this is where many people learn about what about the Bible being history or not. Most of these documentaries on TV are nonsense, and they're deliberately written to attack the Bible in some way. See, to convince somebody in our world, how do you do it? Well, you get a scientist, you get someone with glasses, so I'm up there already, glasses, a white lab coat, holding a clipboard. Now, as soon as you've got someone like that on TV, it's true, isn't it? You might want to say you're not that gullible, but you are that gullible. We are. You get something there. Now, the other way is you have a documentary. And so the documentary is the new tool that you use for proving your point. Because as soon as people see a documentary, they say, it must be true. But I want to encourage you, when you see these types of things around, to actually look it up and consider what they do. And in this case, here is this man who's meant to be an eminent scholar, and he hasn't actually even read what the Bible's saying that he's making these comments about. Okay, so what I want us to do today is to actually consider the evidence. I want us to consider the evidence for the New Testament. Now, how are we going to do this? Well, I want to do it as we would for any other ancient document. How do we do that? Well, I want us to look at what did the writers of the New Testament intend to do? What were they trying to do? Who wrote it? Do their testimonies agree? Does it fit in with the rest of known history? Is it a legend that built up? Or do the events which follow match the events that were claimed to happen? So they're the six questions I'm going to ask. I'll just turn this off here for a sec. Let's have a look at the first of these. What did the writers intend? Now, this is an important question to ask, because if they just weren't even intending to write actual history or actual, you know, truth about Jesus, then there's no use even trying to claim that it's history, is there? You know, we've actually got to look, what were these men who wrote these documents, what were they trying to do? Now, I've given you one quote here from 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16. He says, "We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And there are actually about 10 or 12 references like that throughout the New Testament from a whole range of different authors. They make it very clear that what they're claiming to do is to give you an eyewitness account to what actually happened in history with the person of Jesus. So that's the first thing we notice with the New Testament. Now, that doesn't prove that it's true, it's just that that's what they're claiming to do. They're not claiming to write a parable, they're not claiming to write like a song, they're claiming to write an account of what actually happened. Well, who are the people who wrote the New Testament? Well, quite simply, this is an important question, because if they're people from hundreds of years after the event, well then, they're not as good as an eyewitness who was from the time. And so we need to look at who actually wrote the New Testament. Well, who wrote it? Well, it was basically the Jesus' disciples, all their companions. I'm just going to particularly look at the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And in those we see that Matthew and John were the disciples of Jesus, his students for several years. And Luke and Mark were the companions of the apostles, and they were scribes who wrote down for the other apostles. This is the unanimous voice from the early church. So when we look at those four documents, it's not that some say Mark wrote this, some say Thomas wrote it. No, no. Everyone says it was Mark, everyone says it was Luke, everyone says it was John, everyone says it was Matthew. This is just the unanimous voice of the early church. Now, we even know from outside of the Bible that Jesus had disciples. And it was normal for disciples to write up the teaching of their master. That's not an unusual thing, it's a normal type of thing. So I've given you a Jewish source there where you can actually see it talks about Yeshua had five disciples. Yeshua is a way of saying Jesus in Aramaic. Yeshua had five disciples, Mattai, Nactai, Netza, Buni and Toda. They're the Aramaic names. But you can see that this Jewish source even testifies to him having these disciples. And again, this is not odd that we find out about a person through their disciples. This is how we learn about Socrates, for instance. Socrates didn't write anything. We only know about Socrates through Plato, who himself was a famous disciple or student of him. Now, there are two objections to what I've said here. I've said that the disciples and their companions wrote this, but people object to this on two bases. One is that they say the Gospels are anonymous works. They're anonymous. There's no name attached to it, and so you can't say who wrote them. They're anonymous. And I want to say, it is true that the name of the author is not specifically mentioned. But this does not mean that they're anonymous. At Focus, we hand out brochures and leaflets all the time that I don't put my name on. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. That doesn't mean it's anonymous. See, anonymous is where you deliberately seek to hide your identity. So you don't fill it in, so people actually can't find out. But that's not what they're doing here. It's not that they're setting things up so that you can't know who they are. These are the men who started the first churches. These are the men who travelled around on the missionary journey who were known to the first churches. And for whatever reason, the custom was that they didn't put their name on these documents. But it's a big step to say, therefore, they wrote them anonymously so that no one could know who they were. That's going beyond the evidence. All we know is that they didn't put their name on it, but that their names were, but they were certainly known universally to the church. The other one is that people will often deny authorship to the apostles because they'll say the Gospels are written too late. Now, if you watch a program like the one I just showed you before, or the one that's on the ABC at the moment, on Compass at the moment, they will say that the Gospels were written in the 2nd century. Some will even say in the 3rd century. Which is a bit rough because we've got a fragment of one from 125 AD, so I don't know how it... Anyway, that's what they do. But what they'll do is they'll say the Gospels are late documents. They're later, and of course Matthew, he couldn't be 150 years old in writing this, could he? So he couldn't have written it. But what they never tell you is how they date it. See, when someone gives you a date, the New Testament, you know, the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Matthew is... you know, 125 AD, you want to say to them, where do you get that date from? Because we never ask that question, and when we hear those scholars, we just hear scholars say. Well, scholars say pretty well anything. We've got to be honest, scholars say anything. So some scholars say this should be a fair way of saying it. Now, the way that they never tell you is this. This is how they date it. This is how most of the dating in the New Testament is done, and I've given you a reference there from a liberal scholar who really shows this. Called Redating the New Testament. But what they do is they look at the New Testament, say the Gospel of Matthew, and they say, what can we use to date it? Because there's no date that's been written at the beginning. So they look at it and say, how can we fit this into history to try to date the document? And what the key way is the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So in 70 AD, the Romans came and destroyed the temple. Now, when you read the Gospel, Jesus actually predicts that the Romans would come and destroy the temple. Now, when people date the New Testament, they take this historical fact and they say, well, there's this prediction of Jesus that the temple's going to be destroyed. That must have been written after the event. I mean, how could Jesus have known? And so this is their whole presupposition that they come with, that there is no such thing as prophecy. There is no such thing as God sending prophets. So when we read Jesus predicting this, it must have been written after the event. I mean, how could he have said it before the event? But that's a big presupposition, isn't it? That they don't tell you. that they actually don't believe that God sends prophets. In many ways, they don't even believe in God. And so they just date it according to this. But I want to say, what if God has sent a prophet? What if Jesus did predict the future? Then you actually come up with a completely different date for the book. But you need to realise that this is how they date the book, and this is how they engage with the historical question. I want to say it's quite deceitful. It's also rather ignorant of the Bible. Because in the Old Testament, in Daniel chapter 9 verse 26, which even the most liberal unbelieving scholar will admit was hundreds of years before Jesus, it's actually predicted that the temple will be destroyed when the Messiah comes. So even if you don't believe in prophets, it was already there. Jesus could simply be passing that on. The Gospels could be written in 40 AD. It could be written in 60 AD, or we don't really know. But the universal testimony of the church is that the disciples wrote these, and they were his intimate disciples. They were trained by him, sent out by him. They were the right people in the right time. Now, the third test I want to do is, do their testimonies agree? Do their testimonies agree? I'm just going to look at Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And we see here that they all agree pretty well on all the basics. So that Jesus travelled in Galilee, this is in the table you've got before you there, that Jesus travelled in Galilee, performed miracles, was crucified and resurrected. That's all there in the different Gospels. So these four testimonies we have all agree. But people would say, well, okay, they might agree in broad strokes, but when you get down to the small details, it's full of contradictions. One of the classic places people go to is to the resurrection accounts. And they'll say the resurrection accounts can't be reconciled. If you line them up, they're all contradictory. They don't agree with each other. Now, it is true that they don't fit together easily. But that is actually the case with any history. When you get genuine historical accounts, people pick up different aspects. And fitting the different accounts which pick up different aspects, fitting those together is not always easy. But you actually can do it if you sit down and do the work. And you can do it with the resurrection. I'll give you an example to show you how this works itself out. So if we look at this one here. So when we look at Matthew 20 and Luke 18, we're going to do a comparison here. So we've got here, as Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside. When they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." And then in Luke, as Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Now, what are some of the differences between those accounts? It's obviously referring to the same account.
Leaving Jericho.
Yeah, now that's a pretty big one, isn't it? See, as Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, and then in Luke, as they are approaching Jericho, that says, and what was the other one? The number of blind men. So in the first one, it's two. In the second one, it doesn't say it's just one. It just says a blind man. Well, I'll look at that blind man issue first of all. Now, you see, is that a contradiction? In one it says two, in the other it says a blind man. Well, I don't think that's a contradiction at all. I think that is just normal historical accounting of events. In Matthew, he has specified how many men there were. He said there were two. In the second one, it doesn't say there was one blind man. I think that would contradict it. It just says a blind man called out to him. Now, I guess an example might be, I might be taking my family somewhere and I need to go and drop something off at your place, and I bring some of my kids, I go to the front door, drop it off, and you might say, that was Sam at the front door. Now, it was actually Sam and a few of his kids. But just to say it was me, you know, it's not a contradiction, it's just I'm not telling you all the information, and that's all that's happening there. So I think that one can be explained as just normal historical method. But what about this other one? Leaving Jericho or approaching Jericho? Now that seems a bit harder. How are we going to, you know, think of our way around this? Well, when I first read that, I was a bit shaken. I thought, wow, that seems to be saying, you know, it's clearly the same event. So I went and got the New Bible Dictionary, and I looked up which is a great resource telling you different things. And I looked up Jericho and I just started reading. And I found out a very interesting fact. And the fact was this, that at the time of Jesus, King Herod had, and his sons had begun a building program at Jericho. And there was old Jericho and they were building a new Jericho next door to it. And between these two cities, which are both Jericho, was a really high traffic area. Because, you know, people were going from one part of the city to the next part of the city. And so that was a really great place to beg because that's where everyone's going between those cities. So if you're actually in that place, you're actually leaving Jericho and approaching Jericho at the same time. You could actually be in it. And it's not just like it was only this sort of little, you know, just like 1 metre gap. It's a bit of a thing. So you can be going into Jericho and leaving at the same time. And so what appears to be a contradiction, when I dug a bit more, I actually found out, no, there's a possible answer to this, which actually makes a lot of sense, so that both are right. Now, what this means is that you should be careful before you judge the Bible. You should be careful before you judge it, because the Bible actually may be far more accurate than you're in a position to judge. I want to give you just one more example here. In the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, it's recorded there that King Belteshazzar was the last Babylonian king in power when the Persians and Medes conquered. And for hundreds of years, people thought the Bible's got it wrong because the Greek historians tell us that Nabonidus was the Babylonian king. So you've got a choice there. You've got the Greek historians or you've got the Bible. Now, who do you think people are going to go for? Well, of course, the Bible must be wrong. That's just the default setting, isn't it? And the default setting is doubt the Bible. That's just where people are. Well, anyway, I think it was towards the end of the 19th century, they actually dug up a big stone record from the Babylonians themselves. So these are actually the Babylonians who were the kings at that time. We found their records, and they specified that the final king, in fact, was Belteshazzar, as the Bible had said. And that the Greek historians had got it wrong. Do you know, when you read your Greek history, it can be wrong. Because the Greeks were just trying to do the best they could with their sources, and they sometimes got it wrong. But for all these years, people were saying the Bible's got it wrong, because Greek history tells us. When we dug up more evidence, it was actually that the Bible was right. So again, the Bible is very often far more accurate than we're in a position to judge. And so you need to be careful before you judge it. So it's reliable in that regard. Now, the fourth test I want to do is, does it fit into known history? What I mean by this is, we've got different accounts. We've got Greek history, Roman history, Persian history, Jewish history. We can read all these different historical sources, gather them all together, and try to make a big picture as to what was happening. So when we do that, and then we get the New Testament, does it fit into that broader picture? And in many ways, we should expect that it would. There may be difficulties, as there are with any historical documents, trying to fit them in, because we don't know everything. But it should broadly fit in there. Now, what we find with the New Testament is that it does fit in, that it names the kings who are the right kings at the right times in the right places. It even gives government rulers who are just really minor government rulers their right titles, which were only titles given in a very small area of land and not even known elsewhere. So we actually find that it is historically reliable. I just want to give you, I've got a table there for you of all of the references I could get together. There's not a huge number, but here are the direct ones about John or Jesus, John the Baptist or Jesus in some way. So if you look there, that Herod killed baby boys, that's recorded elsewhere, that John the Baptist came and was preaching to Israel, preaching repentance and baptizing. A lot of these come from the works of Josephus. Josephus is a non-Christian Jewish historian from the first century. And you can see how much he wrote. So it's a fair bit there. So he's a first century, he wrote in the last half of the first century. And he records John the Baptist. Talks about John the Baptist, what he did, how people came to him, how he was put to death by Herod. He talks about how Jesus was known as a miracle worker, and that he was crucified, as does Tacitus, the Roman historian from just at the end of the first century, and also the Babylonian Talmud records that as well, which is a Jewish source. But I want us to have a look at one in particular here. Because it's one thing to say, okay, John existed, you know, well, I can find evidence outside the Bible that John existed and that Jesus existed. But it's still another thing, because the Bible's got all these stories about miracles and miraculous things happening. So just to say they existed is one thing, but to go further and to look at the miraculous is another. So I'll give you an example here from the book of Acts. It says, then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there a while. He had been quarrelling with the people of Tyre and Sidon. They now joined together and sought an audience with him. Having secured the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted, "This is the voice of a god, not a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down and he was eaten by worms and died. So he's struck down, he's got some worm thing, like agony, whatever, and then he dies. Now you can look at that, and that's the classic sermon illustration, isn't it? See? You politicians, you remember this. If you overstep the mark, remember what happened to Herod. It's one of those great stories where the guy does a thing and he's struck down immediately. Well, it's very interesting that that event is actually recorded by non-Christians as well. So let's just have a look at that to see how the Bible goes compared to what other people were saying. On the second day, Herod put on a garment made wholly of silver and of a contexture truly wonderful, and came into the theatre early in the morning, at which time the silver in his garment, being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's ray upon it, shone out after a surprising manner, and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those who looked intently upon him. And presently his flatterers cried out, one from one place and another from another, though not for his good, that he was a god. And they added, "Be thou merciful to us, for although we have hitherto reverenced thee only as a man, yet we shall henceforth own thee as superior to mortal nature." Upon this, the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. Now, I'll just skip down a bit further here. And he saw an owl sitting on a certain rope over his head and immediately understood that this bird was a messenger of ill tidings, as it had once been the messenger of good tidings, and fell into the deepest sorrow. A severe pain arose in his belly, and it began in a most violent manner. And therefore, and then he looked upon his friends, and he then says, "You've done the wrong thing." And then we'll go down to here. When he had said this, his pain had become violent. Accordingly, he was carried into his palace, and when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed this life. And he said, you can't back up everything that the Bible says. It's not that I can give you a reference from the Bible. You know, I can't give you a reference from outside the Bible for every reference that happens in the Bible. But when we can get a reference from outside the Bible, it actually agrees with the Bible. Okay? And so the Bible does fit in to known history. Now, it may seem to you that, you know, I've only got one other book to compare it to and a little bit from Tacitus, the Roman historian, and a few snippets from the Babylonian Talmud. But remember who they are. They're the Romans. They're the non-Christian Jews. Both Josephus and the Talmud, these are people who are actually opposed to Christianity, still recording and confirming things that the Bible says. It may not seem like a lot, but you need to realise that when we talk about someone like Muhammad, we don't have any reference to him outside of Islamic sources. So there are, even though this is the 6th, 7th century, and he was meant to be engaged with all the Roman rulers across to the West, there's not a single reference to him anywhere. only from Islamic sources. The same is true of Buddha. There's nothing from him except from very, very, very late Buddhist traditions. So there's actually far more for Jesus than for anyone else. His existence, his death on the cross, from multiple sources, hostile to each other, all testifying to the same things. It fits in with the rest of history. Just briefly want to look at, is it a legend that has built up? What I mean by this is, did Jesus just start off as a good man, and then after being a good man become a prophet, and then after becoming a prophet becoming the Son of God, and then it just builds up. You know how legends build up over time, like King Arthur or something like that. Well, the evidence that we have when we look at all the documents is that that's actually not the case. The oldest documents we have are actually the gospel documents that we have. And in those, Jesus is just the Son of God, dying for sins, rising from the dead from the word go. And I've given you a few references here. I'll only look at one of them though, just the first one. These are actually from non-Christian sources talking about Jesus and Christians, and talking about what they do. And so you can see the dates. It's 90 to 150 AD. So that they're early documents looking at what the Christians do. It says, Balaam looked forth and saw that there was a man born of a woman who should rise up and seek to make himself God and cause the whole world to go astray. Therefore, God gave power to the voice of Balaam that all the peoples of this world might hear, and thus he spake. Give heed that you go not astray after that man, for it is written, God is not a man that he should lie. And if he says he is God, he is a liar, and he will deceive and say that he departeth and come again at the end. He saith, and he shall not perform. You see that Jewish account there. Now it's attacking other Jews who are Christians, and what's it saying? It's saying that there's a man who's arisen who's claimed to be God. I mean, that's obviously talking about Jesus and people saying that he's divine. But look at when this is. It's you know, the end of the first century. So when the Da Vinci Code movie comes out and they tell you that it was in the fourth century that it was decided that Jesus was divine, what about this? Here are the enemies of Christianity actually saying this is what Christians believe about this bloke. We also see here though that it's also that he's going to come again. I've given you some other references that you can look up yourself. But it's all about Jesus being worshipped, Jesus dying on the cross, Jesus rising again. This is what the outsiders observed of Christians from the very beginning. So there's no evidence that it's a myth that just developed under Constantine, as people would have us believe. But it's just always been these truths being taught. So it's no legend. The final point I want to look at just briefly is, if Jesus did die and rise again, do the events that then happened after that fit that type of thing happening? I'll give you an example. It is taught to you that Captain Cook discovered Australia for the British Empire and set it up for the British Empire. Now, none of us are around to scientifically prove that. We have to go by documents, and we'd have to take some of these documents on face value and just trust them that that is the case. But you can also just say, well, if he did come and make Australia a British colony, there's a certain effect that would happen. That is, people would speak English, which we do. We're not speaking French, are we? Imagine if they said, no, the French actually set up the colony and the French did all this stuff. Well, why aren't we speaking French? Why don't we have French rules? Why do we have a monarchy? Because all of when you look at our history, it lines up with Captain Cook setting it up as a British colony. Well, sorry? Have a Union Jack. Exactly. There are all these things. Now, with Jesus' death and resurrection, we see that the events that flow after that actually are consistent with him dying and rising again, and that they're certainly not inconsistent with it. So the church begins, and it begins teaching that he died and rose again. His disciples who followed him and went out preaching, most of them were martyred for what they were teaching. Now, I can understand that someone who's been deceived would give up their life for what they believe. I can understand how someone could do that. But I can't see how the people who started, who are the deceivers, if you're going to be sceptical, how they would willingly die for what they know is a lie. Right? So that doesn't make sense. You've got to have, they're obviously dying for something that they're saying they saw. Like they're saying that they're dying for what they saw, not for what someone else told them. So it makes sense that something happened. When you read all the letters that then are starting to be produced by the apostles and various people, they're all about Jesus dying and rising again. And you've also got to explain the major shift in Jewish theology. See you later. You've got to explain the major shift in Jewish theology, because what happens now is that the whole Old Testament, which Jews had been following, now thousands of Jews are now starting to say, we're not going to follow it anymore like that. We now actually don't have to keep the Old Testament law. Something's happened which changes our whole religion, and something's got to explain that. So, well, we've got some people there, so we better make a move, although we're not late. Yeah, I know. So my overall conclusion is that when you subject the Bible to the normal tests of history, it goes well. It fits in, and there is evidence for Jesus, and you need to take that on board. People who doubt the New Testament cannot do so just on historical grounds. You may doubt it, but people do it for other reasons that they've already come to. And so I ask you not to be gullible and just believe anything, but I also ask you not to be closed-minded and ignore the evidence that is there, but instead to read the Gospels, consider the life of Jesus, and consider what the Gospel's about. Thank you. Okay.